Hi, I'm David. I'm alcoholic. I just want to take this in for a second. This is a bit overwhelming. I've never done this and jet lag at the same time. So, and I thought I had a couple more minutes. But it's such an honor to be asked to speak at a conference, and it's really strange, too. You get... I did this a few times about 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, a while ago, and that was that. And then I got this call out of the blue in March from Lorraine. It was wonderful to speak here. And I was like, how did you hear it? Like, how did you find me? And she told me it had to do with the tape people, and they suggested me, and I said, I don't really know them. It's like kind of interesting. So it's sort of like, it's very weird as someone who's a drunk in a chair or an Alcoholics Anonymous to like be asked to be in front of like this, in this huge, huge forum. So it's really humbling, and it's really scary, and it feels like a responsibility, and I've, you know, hit my knees and prayed like someone else told me to do last night, and I'm just going to try to tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it is, what's like now. And so here we go. And I love Los Angeles. I haven't been here for a while. I was thinking about my brother lives out here. I think he lives in Woodland Hills. He doesn't like us very much, the rest of the family, but. His loss, but when he got married about 20 years ago, I remember, because in addition to my little problem with alcohol and martinis and Jack Daniels, and I also had a little prescription pill problem. I didn't really care whose name was on the prescription, but I liked them, and then when that got too difficult, then I just forged them, so... the prescriptions, that is. And so for his wedding, about, must be 20, 21 years ago, I remember coming out here with bottles and bottles of all different kinds of pills just that I needed. I mean, I was taking, like, you know, 40 codeines a day just to, you know, be normal. And so anyway, it was, but I never, and I thought about it now when I came out this time, I never thought about bringing that on the plane, that would have been a problem. I never was scared. But now... I was going to tell you my statistics. My sobriety date is November 17th. I'm very nervous. November 17th, 1988. So I have 18 and a half years. I just turned 50 in March, which also will have me forgetting names as I go on. And that's interesting, too. So on the flight here, when I was packing, I was very nervous that, because with the liquid stuff, and I figure they check your bags more. And I had this, in this little, like, baggie, I had this powder. And I thought, oh, my God, they're going to ask me what this is. And then I realized it was Metamucil. So that's it. I was like, oh, my God, how am I going to, it's orange flavored. It's not drugs. It's orange flavored. So that's what it's come to, being fearful about being stopped from Metamucil, but not caring about, like, Valium. And so, I don't know. So, yes. I also read, this is like little thoughts coming in my head. I just read, because of what they just read from chapter 3, I was reading in Timer Newsweek, like a week or two ago, that story about that executive who had a problem out here and had been sober, then wasn't, and it said in the article he's now re-enrolled into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, shit, I never enrolled. It's like, do I get credit? Am I non-matriculated? I want my degree. So I read that stuff, I get very, very upset, obviously. In the papers these days, we have a lot going on about us, and it's very upsetting to me, and I just want to yell at all the publicists, so that's my thing. So anyway, so let me tell you about me. I grew up in New York. I'm the middle of three children. My parents are first generation Russian, Romanian, Jewish immigrant. Their parents were. They were born here. My mother was an alcoholic. She wasn't a fun alcoholic. She was functional, but she wasn't fun because when she would drink, one of us was going to get it. And my father was a perfect Al-Anon without ever going to a meeting. He just went to the couch and went to sleep and ignored her. But as a result, we weren't sort of very well protected from her rage. But, you know, it was interesting. When I started drinking, her drinking, I used to know how bad it was going to be by looking at her bottle, because in the break front, it's a word I don't hear much anymore, in the break front, she had, she drank Gordon's vodka, like as martinis. But, down the side of the bottle, it would say G-O-R-D-O-N. So I would try to see what letter we were up to, you know, by the time she got back from work and how low it was going to go. And I got, and then later years when I was drinking and drinking her vodka and I would fill it with water, I go like, oh, okay, what letter was it at? I don't want to get in trouble. Like, oh, which O is, oh, there are two O's. Shit. So, you know, we mock the thing we are to be. And, but I was this kid who was very, alone, very lonely, didn't feel like I felt in, and by like 12, I felt I had done it all and my life was over. I mean, I hadn't done anything, but it was like, I used to go by myself to the theater. I would go by myself on Sunday matinees in theater, and I remember when I was like 14, seeing Follies, and when I heard the song, I'm Still Here, I identify as a 14-year-old. It was good times, bad times. I see them all, and my dear, I'm still here. I've been through the gamut A to Z. And I felt that's what I... It's just kind of sad and hysterical at the same time that I felt like such an old soul. And I felt really tired, and I felt like I didn't fit in, and I felt like that no one would understand me. And so I retreated to that world. And... I think I retreated to leave my house, because I remember people say, oh, David, you love the theater. I said, no, I usually would leave after the first act a lot. I would just, like, needed some place to go, and I'd be like, okay, I'm here. That's sort of my life. It's like, I always, like, was always looking for the next thing to do. So I was this really lonely kid. I only had one friend at a time, because that's all I could deal with, and I always had one best friend, and if they, like, you know, they didn't do something I liked, then I would never talk to them again. I mean, Alan Breitbart was my best friend until sixth grade, then she didn't want to go to movies with me one day, so I never talked to Alan Breitbart again. So then I got a next new friend. It was like, I just needed enough to feel that I was connected, that it wasn't so awful, but I really couldn't have any room for anyone in my life, which I hear is a little bit about, like, an alcoholic, that you know, that I can't quote any well anymore. I'm 50 now. I can't remember anything. But it's like the part where, like, oh, we had no use for people, basically. There's something in there. Someone will tell me. When they shake my hand later, they can tell me exactly where. So, I was just a lonely kid, and the minute I started to drink and smoke pot, you know, it was, you know, the early 70s, I felt okay. But I wasn't one of those, like, drunks that were like, I feel okay, now I could be around people. It was I felt okay not to be around people. It was okay now. And that's basically how I drank. So I don't have, like, this big rock and roll story of all these things that I did and happened to me, and and this woman, I go to this kinesiologist. I'm all over the place, aren't I? I go to this kinesiologist now, which is a whole other story, because, like, I don't even believe in it. But I figured, okay, well, my boyfriend goes. I was like, all right, so I'll like try to, you know, no contempt for investigation. So as I'm investigating it, and she said to me, I was talking about doing this, coming out here to speak at this conference, and she has a lot of patients that are in recovery, and so she said, well, is it that your story is so, like, great, or is it just, like, the way you tell it? I said, well, my story isn't that great, so maybe I tell it in a way that, you know, that people identify with. But because it's like my alcoholism isn't about being big. It's about being small and staying in my head and being in the prison of my head. And that practically killed me. So I started to drink, like, late in high school. I remember my first drink was at the senior prom, where my date was Sharon Grenley, who later became a lesbian. Surprise. And, well, she was then, but we didn't know what that stuff was then. So my first was gin and tonic. So someone told me, have a gin and tonic. So I didn't know what that was. Okay, I had a gin and tonic. So when I went to college the next fall, my drink became, actually it was gin and Sprite, because that's what they had in the soda machine in the dorm. And what I did, some kids go to college so they can be free of their families, that they could run and around. And like, I was like, thank God I could do morning classes and I could drink all afternoon and watch, you know, All My Children and One Life to Live. And that, and smoke cigarettes. And that's how I went through college. So my high school years, which were kind of fun, sort of, that yearbook, you know, I just moved 2 years ago, so it was like I got to look at all the stuff. My yearbook had like tons of names in it, tons of people on it. My college yearbook, no one. I had no friends. I didn't talk to anybody. It was very sad. I'm not an alcoholic because I'm gay, because it's way in my family. But having that secret or not, it's like I didn't understand that. So I felt different. So I didn't have anywhere to go. And it's interesting because I work with some really young guys in my office who are in their early 20s, where the whole culture is different about being gay, but their lives are so much different from having it in the culture from their earliest years. It wasn't, you know, I just didn't have anyone to talk to. So I spent those whole 4 years drunk and stoned. And the way I found my career was I was sitting at home trying to figure out how to get, you know, Valium from my mother's doctor. And a friend of mine who had been a theater publicist, didn't go to college, he just knew that's what he wanted to be his whole life, he called me up and he said, well, do you want to work here, this PR firm? And I said, okay. It was like, I didn't know what that meant. And I did. But I just worked so I could afford to move out of my parents' house and get drunk. And that's how I spent my 20s, my early 20s. And I was at this job for about 5 years, and they were really loving to me. And I was such a mess that it really broke the owner of the company's heart that he had to have me fired. He had to, like, my immediate boss had to have him fire me, because it was like firing a child. But I didn't get it. I mean, I'd been in therapy, and I remember my therapist, when I was about 22, I was laying on the couch therapy, and she was like, I was complaining about something, because my therapy was always about, like, my life is terrible, da, da, da. And so she, like, started passing pamphlets over my shoulder, and they were AA pamphlets. So I remember I went to a meeting drunk, but Alcoholics Anonymous is very frightening for people who don't want to be around anybody. So I remember I went to this meeting. I didn't quite understand what it was. And I think I put up my hand that I was new. And people came over to me afterwards, and I bolted. Like, I don't want to talk to anybody. I just want to be by myself. I don't know what's wrong. And so that was my first seed of an Alcoholics Anonymous. And so my life sort of went down after I lost that job. I drove a cab for a while. Because my decision to drive a cab was, I said, I can be like an out-of-work actor. I could be a waiter, or I could be a cab driver. And I thought, I'd rather sit down. So it was really, I'm also lazy, and I embrace that. So I became a cab driver, And I would never leave the cab. I would take a lot of pills, and I wouldn't drink and drive, because you shouldn't drink and drive. But I took a lot of pills and drive, and I would bring, like, a bottle with me to pee in, because I didn't want to, like, stop anywhere. And, oh, God, it's hysterical. And I don't know how I did. People don't believe that about me, and they don't believe I was a math major either. Those are two things they don't, like, you were a math, you just made that up, right? No, it was easy to be a math major. You learn 2 pages a day. You don't have to run any papers or read any books. And then you can get drunk the rest of the day. It's like, it was perfectly, made sense to me. So what happened to me was I didn't know that there was help, really. I mean, that one AA thing, that didn't gel or connect. And I was talking to this woman who I'd worked with, and she told me about her son had gone to a rehab. And I just said, what's that? And she said it was 28 days, and he had a coke problem, and I thought, well, that's too bad. But I kind of filed that away. I filed that away because I was then typing at some law firm. I was sort of a temp worker, and they offered me this job. They wanted me a full-time job as a legal secretary, and I was sort of, you know, I was very grandiose. I don't know what I had to be grandiose about, because I'd never done much, but I was sort of offended. But then they gave me the benefits package, and in the medical it said after 90 days you can go to inpatient alcohol and drug rehab, and a little light went off, and I said, this may come in handy. So I took the job, and on my 91st day, I went into a rehab. And quite frankly, I went to the rehab because I thought, I just need a break from all this, and I can just like lay in the hospital bed and watch all my children. It was really how I thought of it. And I lived on 25th Street and 2nd Avenue, New York. The hospital, it wasn't like what I read about promises, or it was like in the fourth floor of a hospital, 10 blocks from my house. It was February, and I walked like carrying a suitcase in the snow, and I felt like, you know, Diane Keaton in Reds, like just going through Siberia. And it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me in my life. And I went there, and it was 1988, and there weren't a lot of people there for just booze or even like the kind of drugs I did, because I was not, it was mostly people there for coke and crack. I didn't quite get coke and crack. I just couldn't imagine paying all that money to stay awake. I just wanted to be out of it. I stole that from my friend Eileen, I have to tell that. I have to say that. It's only fair. You know, we were talking about at dinner tonight, this executive committee took us out, the speakers out, and it was really sweet, and they were talking about this speaker from L.A. and this speaker from L.A. and these, and I said, you know, we don't really have that in New York. There aren't, like, those type of personalities. I mean, the kind of personalities of AA is, like, get him away from the newcomers. It's a different kind of thing. So I thought part of that reason is that you have a lot of conferences and the tapes and I got sober listening to tapes from speakers, and mostly from out here. So that's why I'm nervous. Like, I'll say anything that they're like, that's June G talking. He's stealing that. But most people in New York don't listen to that stuff. But as I get to it, my first sponsor, you know, really blessed me with that, giving me that gift. So I don't know. It's a little different. So anyway, I went to this rehab, and I had this great counselor. Her name was Cho, and she was about 24 or 5. I was about 32, and she was really beautiful and really cool, and she wore these sort of like Laura Ashley-type dresses, and then I'd see her leave at night like in black leather mini skirts and her hair spiked, which I thought was great. But what she gave me was what this program is about, because she had been a heroin addict. And when she talked to me, I believed her, because as it said in the Chapter 3 thing that we read, I did everything to stop. I went, I changed booze, I changed the drugs I took, I went to doctors, I went to psychiatrists, even there was a methadone clinic on my corner where I lived, and I went up there, I was like, I'll go there. And they kind of looked at me and said, no, I don't think so. So I thought, I can't get any help. So when she told me stuff, the light bulb experience for me was we were sitting talking, and she says, we were talking about being an alcoholic and a drug addict, and I had no trouble with the alcoholic part. And she said, what's a drug addict to you? I said, a drug addict to me is, you know, that picture, you know, the spike in the arm on the Bowery, you know, like drool coming out of the mouth. And she says, well, if someone like that were here, what would we be detoxing them with? And I said, I guess methadone. And she says, what are we detoxing you with? And I said, methadone. But you're not an alcoholic like those. You're not an addict like those people, right? And it was like, oh, right, I am. And that was the greatest gift. And it seems like so little, but it was like the weight was off my shoulders. And I also hadn't been out. I wasn't gay. I was actually on the intake, Nurse Beth. I just saw her last week on the street. Nurse Beth said to me on the intake, are you gay? Are you gay or straight? And I was very offended that she asked it in that order. So I said, no, I'm sorry. She said, are you homosexual or heterosexual? And I said, asexual. And she said, no, really? I said, yeah, really. And I made her write it in. Because Because I actually was. It was like I was, you know, I started to come out. And when I started to come out is when the AIDS crisis, and working in the entertainment business, people in my office died really fast early on. It was like, and I just started to like, I think I'd had sex with guys a couple of times, and it was like, all right, not great. So I thought, you know what, I think I'd rather drink. It was like a conscious decision. I think I'd rather drink. And that's how it was. So I was sort of wasn't out. So when I came out of rehab, and I really wanted to be sober, but I didn't quite understand the disease concept of it all. I went to meetings every day, and I didn't drink booze again, but I used again, and I got addicted again. But I still went to meetings every day, and I thought that I couldn't. I didn't know what it was better, but I wanted what you people had. I just didn't know that I could, and which is a desperate place, but not as desperate as it was before, believe you me, because, I mean, I was scamming about 50 pharmacies a week. I mean, it was a lot of work. It was a full-time job, let me tell you. I had all these different names. It was really spooky. So what happened was I had this friend, Sharon. I had this friend, Sharon, and I'd followed this group of people to meetings, and I was doing service in and out. I wasn't not going, but I was just using, and I was still going, and I was doing hospitality at this meeting. It was at Payne Whitney Hospital, and I was doing their hospitality, and it was a Halloween weekend, and I got there early because I'd used. So I got there early, and I did this huge spread with pumpkins and cake and the whole thing, and I left. Because I didn't want to see me. So the next day, Sharon said to me, "Did you use yesterday? Were you high?" And I said, "Why do you ask?" She says, "Well, I came. We all came and we saw this thing was all set up, but you weren't here." And she said, "That's David. Like, he shows up, but he's too embarrassed for anyone to see him." And at that moment, I realized, someone noticed me. I'd always felt invisible, that what I thought and felt didn't matter. And that's a double-edged narcissistic sword, because also if it doesn't matter, then I can do anything I want. So it sort of works both ways. But that part of it is that I thought people didn't notice me and I wasn't important enough to care about. And they care. And she said, "Listen, I didn't know this would affecting this way." And she said, "Listen, her fiance, here's guy Glenn, his sister, Sable, did this step workshop. She says, we're all going there this weekend. Why don't you come? You seem to have a hard time on the weekend." So I did this step workshop where first time Alcoholics Anonymous to me wasn't about who's going to like me. Well, do I want to be around these people? Do they know I'm gay? Do they not know I'm gay? Do I know what I am? It was reading the big book and what the steps were. And does this count in my time? No, I'm kidding. And I identify with every word in that book. And I always get angry when people say at meetings, the newcomers, "Well, if you can't sleep at night, read the big book because it'll put you right to sleep." I identified with every word that those guys said in that book. And so I asked this woman, Sable, who did this at one of her services. I know she lives up here now. I haven't seen her in about 15 years or so, but she was a big personality and really helped me. And I asked her to be my sponsor. So she said, "Well, I have a lot of sponsees, but if you want to be my sponsor," I'm sorry, Glenn told me to get close. "If you want to be my sponsor, my sponsee, you need to go to a meeting every day, sit in the front, go to a step meeting once a week, preferably the same step meeting so you have some continuity. Go to a big book meeting every week. Make 3 phone calls a day. Give your phone number to someone with less time than you. If you have 10 days, there's someone there with 2 days. And do service. And if after that you want to call me and piss and moan, then you can." But I was so tired after all that. But the point was, I've said that to sponsees and then never heard from them again, you know. So, mostly, actually. And I was so beaten up, being high here and wanting to be here is painful. And it was, she saved my life. She really, like, doing that, being that willing, my being that willing and her, you know, giving me those directions saved my life. And I did that. And it gave me the greatest foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm grateful for to this day. And she was my sponsor for about a year. And actually, my favorite story of, because she never really had much time for me, or she was in school too at the time. I remember once after some meeting, somebody said to me, someone said something I didn't like, and I went home and I thought, oh, I'm going to drink. And I walked by that rehab because it was on my way home, and I like looked at the fourth floor and I said, never again. I'm not going to go to that person saying that. I'm not going to go. And I went home and I called her and I said, you made the mistake of saying I thought I was going to drink. And she said, oh, really? There must be something wrong with your relationship with God. Click. And I got it. I was being dramatic, and I got it. So my relationship with God, that was a good segue, I didn't have a lot of God baggage. I was like a lot of people from my neighborhood. We were bar mitzvahed and then never went to a temple again. So that's, you know, you had the big dinner. And so I didn't really carry around a lot. And I used the room as the higher power. I used the people as the higher power because they knew something I didn't. And I remember the first time I got on my knees and prayed, I sort of looked over my shoulder. I got all sweaty, and I got, like, all embarrassed, like someone is watching me. And I thought, oh, right, who would be watching me? Oh, it's God, right, okay. So I was told, if you ask for a sober day in the morning and thank God for a sober day at night. And then I remember some guy, I have 33 years and I've never heard anyone drink who said that in the morning and night. I said, okay, I'll go with that. That's fun. That's fine. And I did a lot of service. And service was really good for me because I was so shy and shut down. But this was the first place that I started to have a voice and that people would know me. And so when we started to work the steps, and the way we worked the steps was really simple, because I have to do things really simply. And she said, you know, do you feel you're powerless over alcohol, that your life has become unmanageable? And my experience, because in the middle, I also had another rehab in that time that I was using, which was not a good experience. And that was clear. And do you believe a power greater than yourself could lead you? And I said, well, you know, I said, I haven't been staying sober, but people have, and I've been watching people come in here, and you watch people in their first year and how they change. There's something going on here. So there's something very powerful happening, and it's, you know, I don't know anything about it, and I haven't tapped into it yet, but there clearly is. And she says, can you make a decision to turn your will and life over to God? And I said, well, you know, I hear people go on about that and say, I don't know, what does it mean to turn over my will and what do I actually do? And she said, it doesn't say to turn over your will. It says make a decision. You can make a decision to do a lot of things, but you need to take the actions to go forward with them. Like she used an example, she had never been to San Francisco, so she's made a decision to go, but until you save the money, buy the ticket, get on the plane, like you're not there. So the way it was explained to me was that making the decision was a commitment to do the rest of the steps. So I said, okay, I can do that. And we did, and then she said, okay, well, next Friday at whatever time we were doing your fifth step. And that's how, and I said, oh my God, but people, like, they write for years and they all go. She said to me she felt it was just a taking some notes to have a long talk with someone to see the patterns that are in your life, things that you need to change so you can be of service to God. So I thought, okay, that was easy. That was easier. It was easy way. I needed an easy way to look at it. And I think I was around 6 months sober at the time and did my first fourth and fifth step. And what it did for me, doing it that early, because, you know, I sometimes hear a step a year. It's like, I don't know where it says that, but people say that. And it's fine. People say sober. And but what it did for me was it made me feel, to use the analogy of doing the homework for school, when I was a kid, if I didn't do the homework, I don't want to be seen. I don't want you to see me. I don't want you to call on me. I don't want to really be here because, and even doing that first, fourth step, however good or bad or indifferent it was, it made me feel like I belonged here. This is my place. You know, I paid my tuition, whatever. I've enrolled. I'm here. And it was very, it made me feel good and made me want to stay. And And we went on, you know, with the sixth and seventh step, and the eighth, she had me do a list now, later, maybe, and never. And the joke of that is the nevers are the ones you probably have to do first, and which is, don't tell the really new people. But you know what, that was very, it was very freeing. And actually, so actually one of my favorite ninth step stories was, years before I got sober, one of the ways I tried to not drink on Saturday mornings was going to social work school. That's how that was my way of doing that. And I met this woman there who was, she was 28, Kathy, and she had just had 10 years sober, and she actually took me down to pick up her girlfriends at High Noon, which is a big Sunday morning, which is sort of like the log cabin of New York. And it was years before I got sober, and I thought, boy, they really look kind of really unhealthy here. It's like, I was like looking at them, boy, they were like, and people, which I'd been in group therapy so many years, and people would like share this stuff and be in tears and hysterical, and then they go on to the next person. I said, no one's talking to them. It's like, they're so mean. So Kathy had this 10th anniversary party, and she invited me. And so it was in Brooklyn, and this was a time when I was stealing from any pocketbook or wallet, anything I could steal for drugs. And so it was a bunch of AA lesbians in this house, and me, and they had, it was a while ago, they had purses, and I got into that room and took whatever cash I could. And I don't recommend that. Don't steal from a group of sober lesbians in recovery. Because they came knocking on my door. In force. So that was the story with her. My ninth step story with her, because when I got sober, I remember seeing her on the street and told her I was sober, whatever. But on my fifth anniversary, one of the things I did was plan a trip out here. I had a friend in L.A., and I had a friend in San Diego, and one in San Francisco. And I did that. And when I was leaving San Francisco, now, Kathy had moved, I think, to Oregon. I'd become a therapist or something. I was in San Francisco on my way home, and I took the super shuttle. You know, the super shuttle only takes three people. So first it picked me up. Then it picked up this other guy, and he said to me, don't you go to AA in New York? And I said, yeah. He says, well, I see you're the chairman, you chair High Noon. I see you there. I go, oh, okay, how you doing? Okay. And the third person was Kathy, going back up there. So I was free to make my amend with her. It was safe because the other person in the car was in the car. It was sort of like, okay, I got it. The amend with my brother around a few years later was he wasn't in Woodland Hills, he was in Calabasas. And I had some sort of amend to make, and I worked for then the sole proprietorship PR guy, and we did theater, but he had this one producer who gave him a client of an orthodonture company. I mean, like, not very obscure. It's not something he would have ever done or whatever, but he did it as a favor. So we were coming out to this firm out here in Calabasas around the same time, around my 5 years. And I didn't know where my brother lived at the time, so I sort of said to my father, doesn't Rand live out in the valley somewhere? Where does he live? He says, he lives in Calabasas. I said, oh, Calabasas, which is a residential, is not really a business neighborhood, but we were going to a business meeting in Calabasas. Okay, I got it. So I made my amends with them. And, you know, the thing about amends is you make your amends and then you move on. So, you know, he still hates us. So. I don't mean the royal us. I mean all my family. So that's just the way it is. So so then, what else happened in recovery? You know, like the amazing stuff about Alcoholics Anonymous and what it's done in my life is that, you know, they use one term I really hate these days that they hear. They use the cash and prizes term. And I'm like, it started like 5 years ago. I'm like, what cash and prizes? What's that? My cash and prizes in AA is that I went from someone so uncomfortable with myself, I hated myself so violently, to someone who's so comfortable in my own skin that it's like scares me. That everything is sort of like, you know, I don't get big highs and I don't get big lows. It's sort of like I have a really nice life of my making. And And I know my limitations, and I know what I want to do and what I don't want to do. And it's sort of like, it's just amazing that people say to me, people at work, they'll say, you really seem so comfortable, and you're just so relaxed all the time. And it's, I want to laugh, because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous does to me. And quite frankly, if I stay away from meetings for 2 days, I'm not that way. I mean, I'm one of those people, I have to go every day, because I wasn't one of those people who had a great life and went bad because of booze. I mean, I never had it, so it's all new. But if I don't go to meetings for a couple of days, I start to have fights with you in my head, and you say all these horrible things to me, and I respond in kind, and then some, and it just goes on and on. And I just, when I go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, even if I sit in the back and roll my eyes, which I am known to do on occasion, which is all fine, it's all good. It's it's 98% of sobriety is just showing up. It's just showing up and sitting in your seat. Sometimes I've sponsored a lot of people. I thought I had one sponsor now, but I don't think I do, because he stopped calling me when I said it's time, we need to work on the steps, so then he stopped calling me. So that happens a lot too. So I feel like maybe I'm a terrible sponsor. That's fine. That's okay. But people will sometimes come up to me who I've never spoken to on their year, and because I pretty much go to the same meetings every day and sit similar places. I try to move a row or two, and they'll say, we've never spoken, but I've seen you here every day, and it's really made it safe and comfortable for me. And sometimes I think, if that's all I have to give, that's something to give. It's not, I don't have to sponsor 17 people and be the center of everyone's life. And some people do that, and that's great. And sometimes I wanted to do that, but it didn't happen that way. And you have in recovery to give what you have to give. We all have different incredible things to give to other people. Sometimes I hear people say things to other people, I go, wow, how did they know to say that? That's really good. That really helped me. So for someone who hadn't had a life, this place helped me to try to get one. And in the work environment, I went back to work in the industry I had been in, and I ended up working for 3 years after I had about a year sober, probably the most abusive person in the industry I was in, famous for it. And he was a little crazy, a little psychotically crazy, and violent, and I had to go through that, because at the very beginning of my working for him, when he would behave that way, which he kind of held off for the first year, I would think, what's wrong with me? Why is this happening to me? Boy. And by the third year when that was happening, it was like, no, nobody treats me like this. Not happening. And I got that all coming here, and I needed to go through that. And when I left that job, and actually this crazy man, he's pretty successful now, but I'm the only person who've ever left his office that we still talk and go to dinner and stuff, because I did it soberly, and I kind of, didn't make it, mean. I didn't respond with what he was giving. And I've worked for the last 14 years at a nonprofit service organization that I've really loved my job. I got to create it. I've been there a long time, and now I'm a little bored, and I can stay or not stay. They treat me really well. I'm pretty autonomous. I like that. I'm a little lazy, like I said, so I could stay there. And that's the crossroads I'm at now. The whole turning 50 was a big deal for me, because when I turned 40, and my 40s were my best years of my life, so to date, there are other things I wanted to do in life, there was time. And now it sort of feels if there's something else I want to do, it's time to get moving and take some actions. And I'm a little scared, and I'm just starting to talk about it, and I'm not even sure what that would be, and it has to do with service stuff, and maybe going back to school, which frightens me no end. I mean, when people in these rooms go to school, everyone who goes to school in AA, the joke is everyone gets an A's. They only get A's. It's true. They listen to all my friends who go back to school. They always I never did well in school when I was young, but now I'm on the D's list. And it's really true. We're really incredible. We do really well. But if that's the one thing for me, I don't think I can do that. I don't have the concentration anymore. But so I'm just starting to talk about that. What else is dating, relationships? That stuff you hear about here. I never ever thought about being in a relationship ever. until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And people talk about it a lot. And after a few years, I thought, oh, am I supposed to want one of these? All right. You know, it kind of, you know, the stuff rubs off. So, with clothes and buy your own apartment. I started the dating thing. You know, I love an AA. We do it like a verb. I need to date now. I have a lot of dating to do. We try to practice dating, and which is interesting, and even if it's someone we like. So I started dating, and there was like, it was interesting because I would always have a good time, and then they would say like, well, you know, you're really nice and you're really funny, but like, I didn't feel like the magic, and like, okay, well, whatever. But don't you know that after a year it doesn't matter? But shh, it's another secret. Anyway, so after years of doing that, I started to date someone who I met at the gym. He was in the rooms. I always wanted to date someone in the rooms. It just never worked out. We started dating, and then my head went to the same place it always went after like the second date. Well, I don't know. And he's got this, this, and this, and it's sort of like, yeah, I don't know, maybe not. And I decided for once to suspend my disbelief and realize, and I think I'd grown up enough coming here and getting older, that listening to all of you and your experiences, that you know what, if they don't have this and this, but like someone else will have that, but then they won't have the, I mean, it's like, you know, so, and then I realized, well, you know what, I was like 46 at the time, it's like, I'm no great bargain either, I mean, no. So I kind of like one date at a time, and so I've been seeing this. I'm one of those people like if you can stay sober, anyone can stay sober. Because I was the person like in my first year, like how many days do you have this week? And now it's like people go, oh, if you can be in a relationship, then there's hope for me. I get that a lot. So I've been in a relationship for 3.5 years, and let me tell you, it is more work than I thank. You know, God doesn't give you more than you. And it took me 15 years sober to get to do this because I don't think I could have done it before. I wouldn't have done it before because I didn't realize. Because you know, where doesn't it also say like we're incapable of forming a partnership with another human being? They're right, because I am self-centered and I want things my way. And what's wrong with you? It's sort of like, you know, like he's at home, he's in my apartment now, and he just emailed me before the meeting, like, do you have an X-Acto knife? Because I need something. I'm like, I'm about to speak, and you know it. And like, you're asking me about an X-Acto knife? Like, when is it ever about me? So that's also a good way to get over your narcissism. When you're a narcissist in the stream, date someone who's more narcissistic. I've gotten so much better. In the past 3 years, people are like, you're so different. You're so, like, not about you all the time. I said, who listen? Anyway, so that's going on. That's going on. Then people say, are you going to live together? I'm like, no, I'm not ready. I don't want to do that. So the last piece that I, aside from the work stuff that I'm trying to, I've been fascinated because part of my job is publicist work, so I get to talk to writers and things, and I'm fascinated by people who have a voice, so like that the public, no, because I'm so shy, I don't, you know, I was smart in school but never raised my hand with the answer. I didn't want to be wrong. I don't want them to look at me, whatever. So I'm really fascinated with people who have a voice, and I know some people and they're not anymore fascinating than you or I, and like what makes them feel confident enough in themselves to express themselves, because I don't have that. So I had a little step in that direction where I was talking to this writer about something, and then we were talking about Rosie on The View, actually, why I loved it, and this is personal. And so, and we were just talking, and he was going to write a piece for the theater part of it, and I just told, but he didn't quite get what I had said, so I just wrote him like a little email, and just personal, just to him, audience of one, and he said, oh, can I publish this in the paper? And I'm like, no, what if I'm wrong? What if someone disagrees with me? What if, like, and then I kind of thought about it. I said, I've been having this thing about finding my own voice, so I thought, well, don't say my job, where I work, because it's not about where I work, because it can be construed that, so just call me whatever, marketing, whatever. So I let him use my name, which was which for some people isn't a big deal. It was a big deal for me taking a stand on something because I'm not used to doing that. But I only started to be able to do that by coming here and like getting through this kind of horrifically scary experience. So sometimes it's really big what goes on here, and sometimes little. And I'm going to quote, this is like, a friend of mine was telling this story. He's from Denmark, and he has a lot of brothers and sisters. He was talking to his mother. He's in recovery here, and he was talking to his mother, and he's saying to his mother, what's going on there? He says, oh, you know, your sister, the doctor, and she just got this big fellowship, and she's doing this. She goes, oh, that's great. And your brother, you know, the architect, he's just got a commission to build this bridge in Japan, and it's, like, really exciting. It's going to be, like, a 5-year project. And she goes, that's great. And she goes, and honey, what's with you? She says, well, I'm just trying not to eat so much ice cream. And, you know, sometimes in recovery, it's just like trying not to eat so much ice cream and just, you know, a day at a time. So anyway, thanks a lot. Thank you, the committee. They've been wonderful.